Warning, the following message may be offensive to some audiences. These audiences may include, but are not limited to, professing Christians who never read their Bible, sissies, sodomites, men with man buns, those who approve of men with man bun enablers, white knights for men with man buns, homemakers who have finished Netflix but don't know how to meal plan, and people who refer to their pets as fur babies. Viewer discretion is advised.
People are tired of hearing nothing but doom and despair on the radio.
The message of Christianity is that salvation is found in Christ alone, and any who reject Christ therefore forfeit any hope of salvation, any hope of heaven.
The issue is that humanity is in sin, and the wrath of Almighty God is hanging over our heads.
They will hear his words, they will not act upon them, and when the floods of divine judgment, when the fires of wrath come, they will be consumed and they will perish.
God wrapped himself in flesh, condescended, and became a man, died on the cross for sin, was resurrected on the third day, has ascended to the right hand of the Father, where he sits now to make intercession for us.
Jesus is saying there is a group of people who will hear his words, they will act upon them, and when the floods of divine judgment come in that final day, their house will stand.
Welcome to Bible Bast, where we aim to equip the saints for the works of ministry by answering the questions you're not allowed to ask. We're your host, Harrison Kerrigan, Pastor Tim Mullett, and today we'll answer the age-old question, is it time to rethink polygamy? Now, Tim, as we kick this episode off, what Bible verse do you have to read for us that's related to the topic of polygamy?
Yeah, sure. So Genesis 2:24, therefore, for this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. So, there you go.
Okay. Yeah. So I guess that's essentially the foundational verse for our understanding of marriage in the Bible, right? I mean, it's pretty much right at the beginning, almost, you know, of the entire Bible. God gives us a definition for marriage. Is that right?
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, this is basically the verse that is brought up by Paul and Jesus at a variety of points when they're discussing the topic of marriage. And basically, I mean, this verse gives you everything you need in order to understand marriage and sexual ethics in the Bible. So when you think about the way that the Bible addresses this topic, this is the verse that's frequently brought up. And when it's brought up in such a way that like certain features of the verse are pointed out to reflect the nature of what marriage is, the nature of what sexual sin is. And I mean, really, you can go through the law and you can think about everything that the law says related to this topic. And it's all built on this foundation. So this is the foundation for marriage that you find in the Bible. And, you know, this is where everyone gets everything. And so a lot of the inferences you draw, I mean, particularly related to, you know, old covenant laws about sexual immorality in general, they're all built upon this foundation. So, you know, when you think about what's actually happening there, it says, therefore, a man shall leave father and mother, hold fast to his wife. So you have a man leaving his father and mother, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of like Jesus's symbolism, like where he presents himself as like the bridegroom who is going to prepare a place for us. You see how it's all built on this foundation. He's like, he's going to prepare a place for us. Well, therefore a man will leave father and mother in order to prepare a place for a wife. And he's going to get married, right? Hold fast to his wife. They will become one flesh. Verse 25 after that says, the man and his wife were both naked and not ashamed. So a lot of like, this is basically the foundation. So you have that formula there, man leaving father and mother, hold fast to his wife. It says they will become one flesh. Yeah. But then when Jesus talks about this verse in a variety of places, he's going to say, and the two will become one flesh, if that makes sense. So he's interpreting, mm-hmm. he's basically giving you the meaning of this. He's not just saying they will become one flesh. He's saying the two will become one flesh. So, you know, the logic of marriage is essentially 1 + 1 = 2. I mean, you can refute the idea of child marriages from this passage, like in the sense that you have the words man and woman. You can refute the idea of sodomite marriages, lesbian marriages in this, with this verse, because it's a man leaving father and mother, holding fast to wife. You know, this tells you something about the nature of like the importance of like the actual what marriage is a sexual relationship. Two will become one flesh. And then a lot of your sexual ethics are going to be built upon this foundation too. So, I mean, it's not a man, like there was no helper found for man among the animals. So that refutes the idea of bestiality.
No dogs.
No dog. It's man. Yeah. It's man like leaving father and mother, holding fast to a wife, his corresponding helper that God has provided for him. So this is basically just your foundational marriage verse in the Bible. All of Christian thought on marriage should be built on this foundation in one way or another. So when we're discussing it, you know, this is the foundation for sure.
Yeah, definitely. It's certainly a very robust verse, right? In terms of defining marriage for us, because like you said, there's so many things that are inherently condemned, as not a marriage by sure. this definition we're given. Right.
And
so,
sure.
so it's certainly a very helpful verse. And obviously it's not the only thing the Bible has to say on marriage, but then whatever we think of marriage has to fall in line with this verse, sure. essentially. Is that what you're saying?
Sure. Sure. Yeah. And there's a lot in there that later interpreters of the Bible, like particularly Jesus and Paul, are bringing out that may not be necessarily intuitively obvious from the start, but then they're there and you should have seen them. So yeah, this is basically a foundational verse for marriage related to this topic. We'll be referring to it at a variety of times during this conversation, I'm sure.
Right. Now, the topic of the episode is not necessarily marriage in and of itself, but polygamy. So right. Why don't we just start? I'm sure probably most people know what polygamy is, but just so we can say that we've covered our bases, can you give us a definition of polygamy and maybe mention too the polygyny stuff?
Yeah, I mean, so polygyny is polygamy is the idea of having like multiple spouses, and then when you're thinking about that along the lines of polygyny is the idea of a man taking on more than one wife, and then you have a term polyandry to describe a woman taking on more than one husband. So polygamy is, you know, in short, it's just basically the concept of an individual having more than one person that they're married to, essentially. So multiple marriages attached to the same person.
Right, right. Yeah. And, you know, this is just totally a side note, but it kind of bothers me that two of the words sound really similar. And then the third one sounds, you know, it uses the same poly, but then it's polyandry instead of, you know, you have polygamy and polygyny. I don't know. Something about that is just like, well, why didn't we?
All right, so part of what's happening there is that those are kind of Greek terms. So polyandry, andros means man, and then and then like polygyny, you know, you have like the word from gynecology, basically. So basically you have like gune is woman wife, and then andros is man. So you know, polygyny and then polygyny.
So all you're saying right now, Tim, is I'm just not nearly as well versed in my Greek as I need to be.
Fail. Yeah.
Yeah. Next time, just say that for me. Just okay. call me stupid next time. Okay.
It may seem irrational if you don't understand Greek.
Yeah. But you know, okay. Putting that aside. So this idea of polygamy, I think probably most Christians, they would pretty much like laugh or scoff at anyone who came along today and said that, polygamy is something that we can do. God allows polygamy. Most Christians would just laugh at that idea. They wouldn't really take it seriously. I think maybe something that, they don't necessarily always consider is the fact that there is actually mentions of polygamy in the Bible, like people practicing polygamy in the Bible. While most Christians, pretty much all Christians, I think rightly so, would condemn polygamy, it kind of seems like, you know, the more I've looked into it, they might not actually know why, right, it should be condemned.
Right.
And so that's kind of what I'm interested in talking to you about and asking some questions to try and give people a better understanding of what the biblical view on, you know, polygamy should be, because, you know, I think probably most people may not even know the arguments that the, you know, pro polygamy Christian might give. So just as a summary, what are some of the arguments that you've heard from the pro polygamy Christians in favor of polygamy?
Well, yeah, I mean, we've had polygamous advocating Christians screaming at our account for the past few days. Some, you know, more in a good natured way than others, but a lot of them, I don't know. It's been strange to watch, because it seems like a lot of them are struggling with basic reading comprehension skills as it relates to this. This seems to be a pretty emotional topic for them, but I don't want to, I don't want to unfairly criticize like people across the board who might be sympathetic to this kind of concept. And what I mean by that is just to say that there are different types of people who are sympathetic to these kind of arguments. So, I mean, we're living in a society right now where we've basically successfully thrown out a Christian sexual ethic at almost every single point. Right. And it's somewhat surprising that we're still holding on to this concept of monogamy. Like, I don't even understand how that's become sacred at this point, particularly in a society where like open marriages are a thing, right? And, you know, quote unquote, bisexual people exist. So like, if you think about like a bisexual person and the logic of like the logic that's been used to advance same-sex, you know, mirage or whatever, same-sex marriage, like the idea that you must be able to express your sexuality in the context of marriage, that's the thing that allowed for, you know, sodomite marriages. But then when you think about it along those lines, I don't understand why we're not at a point right now where a bisexual isn't allowed to express their sexuality in the context of a marriage. And if they do that, that's necessarily a plural marriage. You understand? Mm-hmm. So I don't understand. So basically, you're living in a society right now. I don't know why we're still holding on to monogamy when we have no foundation for it anymore. Yeah, when you think about the topic of polygamy, it is a topic that I would say for myself, for many years, I've had a, like, there's different postures on this, meaning like you can have a, I think most Christians probably have a "it's bad" posture, right? Mm-hmm. And then they have no way of explaining anything that's happening in the Old Testament. So it's just kind of a, it's bad. And part of that's good, because it's like, it's a posture that is basically just built on the Genesis 2:24 kind of stuff, right? In the beginning, right, God made them Adam and Eve. He didn't make them Adam and Eve and, you know, Susan or something, right? Yeah. Whatever. So, I mean, and I think that that's kind of a good Christian impulse to have, but it may not go beyond that. And then, then when you ask them to explain the arguments for, defend their arguments, they don't have any. You know, at that point. So I think that's one posture. Then there's kind of a posture that I've adopted for a long time, which is just to say, it seems very like overwhelmingly obvious that monogamy is the ideal. But then like there's passages in the law where God regulates polygamy, and there's, you know, David had multiple wives. Solomon had, you know, ton, right? 700 wives, or yeah, 300 wives, 700 concubines, whatever it was, 1,000 wives total of different sorts. So it seems like God is regulating it. If he's regulating it, isn't that in some sense basically putting it in a neutral category? So I don't want to go beyond what's written, and therefore I'm not willing to just say it's wrong, right? So that would be my posture for a long time. It would be kind of like I'm not willing to say it's wrong, but it's very unwise, right? So like the one posture is just to say, hey, it's absolutely wrong. I don't really know why. I mean, you know, that you could break that up into, it's absolutely wrong. I know why. I can explain why. And I've met very few people who can give actually good answers to that. It's absolutely wrong. I don't know why. Then there's the, I can't say it's wrong, but it seems very unwise kind of position that I took for a long time. And then I think there's a lot of people like that. And I think a lot of people are in that. I'm noticing the more that you interact on the internet, there's a lot more people like that, particularly of the, they're the kind of person who can see all the sexual confusion out there, can see all the different ways in which egalitarianism and feminism have taken over our thought in terms of marriage and everything else. And they're basically saying, like, we've been wrong on so much. Like, are we wrong on this too? So I have a certain kind of sympathy for that kind of person. And then I think there's like, there's the guys out there who are, not only is this like, not only is this permissible, but this is like biblical marriage, right? like that kind of idea. Like this, not just that I think it's permissible, but unwise, but it's like, this is what God intended. God intended for men to have multiple women. And it's only like the, you know, these like female worshipers out there who are ruled by the, ruled by women essentially at this point, living in the longhouse, who are preventing us from taking, you know, the multiple wives that we deserved. And I mean, that kind of person I am legitimately a lot more concerned about than the middle category kind of person who basically doesn't have the arguments yet, but maybe is thinking about it a lot more than the person who just rejects it without any thought. You know, like the kind of that kind of person is typically the kind of person who's looking at a lot of porn, and like basically they've defined lust in such a way that they're never guilty of it. And you know, so they're basically kind of like the lust filled kind of person who's just like, hey, yeah, this is the way to go, and we need to make it happen, right? And so they don't have any of the basic Christian impulses towards guarding their mind and guarding their thoughts and everything else at that point, because they really do believe that God would permit them to like to desire any unmarried woman they want, right? And then go make a wife out of her. And so, yeah, I mean, that's the kind of person I'm more concerned about for sure. But you're asking me, what are their arguments, right?
Yeah, just like a general overview over some of the more prominent arguments that they might make. Because I think there's a lot of people out there who would probably not even know what they are.
Yeah, so, all right. A lot of the primary foundational argument that they're going to make at that point is the argument that we've fundamentally redefined adultery. So, the idea is that like adultery under this view, right? And it's basically a Jewish view that Jesus came to rebuke. Okay. So this was a Jewish view that was alive at the time, but Jesus came to basically give us a authoritative interpretation of Exodus 20, which says you shall not commit adultery. So Jesus came along and gives us this authoritative definition. But what the polygamy, the pro-polygamy kind of view at this point is basically saying that it's basically taking that Jewish view and sanctifying it and saying that's the right view. Okay. And so the right view would involve a double standard, like as it relates to the subject of adultery. So meaning like the Jewish view at that point, and like the polygamous kind of view, is that adultery means like adultery is when a man, has sex with another man's wife. So, and then it's when a woman who is married has sex with anyone but her husband. You see, so there's an inbuilt kind of asymmetrical standard there, right? Yeah, so when the woman can't have sex with anyone but the husband, right? But then like the idea there is just to say adultery is when it's only like when it's with the man, it's only when he's having sex with another man's wife, essentially, at that point. So then like, so under that, because like the idea is that polygamy is okay, so because polygamy is okay, then that's your definition of marriage. And I would say that like if you actually read through the Old Covenant laws, there's nothing in the Old Covenant laws in particular. Like if you were just to start out with that assumption that there is that double standard, that like the Jewish like assumption there at that point, you start out with that assumption and you read like a variety of verses within the law, and what you'll find is there's nothing within like the laws themselves which seem to make you adopt the conventional view today. Does that make sense? The conventional view today is adultery is when a married person has sex with someone besides their spouse, whether man or woman, right? So there's nothing within the past. Like, so when adultery is mentioned like that, it's always mentioned in the context of a man sleeping with another man's wife. Okay. So that's the big point that they're trying to make. That's the big, like, that's the biggest point they're trying to make. And then, you know, then they're going to appeal to, just all the examples. And I mean, there's example after example of the patriarchs having multiple wives. Right. Yeah. So, and, you know, like, I think the former argument is something to think about. But then, like, this argument, I consider this next argument, like, really bad. Like, meaning they'll point to the arguments that they'll point to, like, the reality that the patriarchs had multiple wives, and they'll say, we had a troll basically saying that on our account, like, well, Abraham had, you know, he walked in God's statutes and rules and everything else, but then, you know, he had multiple wives, Hagar and Sarah, and, you know, therefore you're calling him evil or something. It's like, well, he's not sinless. This is Abraham. Like, this is the guy who, handed his wife over to the pagans because he was a coward, you know?
Yeah.
Like, the text says when he took Hagar that he listened to the voice of, and this was really interesting. It says he listened to the voice of Sarah, and mm-hmm. it, just like Adam listened, you know, because you listened to the voice of your wife, he listened to the voice of his wife. It's the same phrase, right? That happens, you know, 12 chapters earlier or whatever. So, I mean, at this point, like, these are, like, the way you read narratives, the way you're supposed to read narratives is you're supposed to, like narratives will show you theology. They don't necessarily tell you theology. There's not like an editorial note every time they do something bad says that was wrong, right? So they'll do some, yeah. And they shouldn't have done that, you know. So as like Jacob swindles, you know, everyone in the whole point of this, through the story, you know, that was the bad move that they just did right there, you know, like, so
Moses literally kills a guy.
You could think about like that at every single point where Moses is basically telling God, like, no, I don't want to, I'm not a mouthpiece, and God's like, who made your mouth or whatever? He's like, I still can't do it. He's like, okay, we'll make Aaron do it then. It's like, well, that was the man of faith right there, you know. So then you point it's like, yeah, obviously they are, yeah, but like, this is not the way you read narratives. You don't read narratives like that. But so the argument, main argument, is like adultery is being redefined. And so, like, our definition of, like, adultery that everyone just assumes, like, you have sex with someone who's not your spouse, they're saying that's, like, that's wrong. That's a redefinition. Argument two is, like famous people in the Bible had multiple wives, so therefore we can't throw them under the bus because God calls them at various points, like, men of faith and, you know, walk righteous and walking in God's statutes and rules and everything else, just like David, you know. So read through the law. God says that David, there was no king like him. He walked in all the statutes and rules and everything else. It's like, yeah, but he also messed up a little bit. And you see that in the narrative too. So I consider that a bad argument. A lot of it relates to the fact that the law actually regulates polygamy in a way that is a bit surprising. So, I mean, if polygamy is just like wrong, if it's just wrong, why is God regulating it? It would seem a lot simpler just to outright condemn it, just to put a statement in the law that says you shall not do this, period, the end, right? So mm-hmm. why is that? Why is it being regulated in that way and not condemned? And so I consider that a better argument than the one I just mentioned. There's the idea, I think they make a lot about, like, God saying to, when God rebukes David for the Bathsheba incident, he says that he gave him his master's wives, right? And he gave him, you know, lands and properties and everything else. And if that was not, if that wasn't enough, I would have given you more. I mean, the implied answer is it was enough. But so the idea is then that God, like, is, he's not condemning it. Like, there's no condemnation. Then you're adopting the Jewish definition of adultery. And then what you're doing is you're basically taking that, like, that kind of example of God giving multiple wives to David as approval in that way of the whole idea. And then you basically do that in such a way as to ignore everything else, you know? What I mean, like, when a person takes a more modest posture to say, hey, this always goes bad, like in the narratives, it's always going bad. But I don't know that I can condemn it. For some reason, God's not condemning it. But then to say that this is biblical marriage, this is something that the Bible is advocating, it's like, you know, you have to read the rest of it. those would be the main arguments that I've heard people making and considered myself. I mean, there's more, but I mean, that's the starting point for sure.
Well, yeah, I think one of the concerning aspects of everything you brought up for me is just the fact that, you know, I mean, where in the Bible is polygamy mentioned in a positive manner? Yeah. You know, I mean, pretty much everything I can think of, you know, especially in the Old Testament, obviously, since that's where pretty much all of the mentions are going to be. They are all negative. Like there's issues with all of them, which makes sense because it just seems like you are marriage is already hard. So sure. Anyone listening to this that thinks that, you know, maybe they're single right now and they're thinking just once I get married, my life will be so much easier. It's not. You know, I mean, it's better. It's for sure better, but it's not easier. And so then you think about adding in a third person, even just one, like a third person into that. That's really hard. And then you've got to factor in like the, you know, think about the rivalry that is tempting to be formed there and whatnot. It just seems like at best an incredibly unwise thing to enter into, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is where a lot of people who are flirting with this idea should actually spend more time reading through the narratives themselves, and just see how this goes. You know, so you think about what's happening. Like God creates man, he puts him in a garden, and you're supposed to get your fundamental theology of what marriage is on the basis of what you're finding there. You know, so that's going to tell you everything that marriage is. Like that's the foundation. Like, and it's just. The thing is, it's so central to the story of the Bible, meaning like you have Genesis, this book of origins right at the beginning, right? That tells you like who man is, why he's here, what God's purpose is for him and everything else. And so, I mean, I think if you just, let's refute these arguments, but then one by one, but let's take a step back and talk about what you're talking about, like why it's bad, like, you know, why it's presented as bad, like in an obvious way. Well, I mean, like, think about, like, the foundation of the Bible. The foundation of the Bible is God creates man. He puts him in a garden to work and to keep it, right? He's given dominion over the animals. God declares him, be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, and subdue it. So he's given dominion over the animals. He's made a ruler of the planet, right? And then God says, it's not good for him to be alone. So I'm going to make, what does it say? Make a helper fit for him, right?
Mm-hmm.
Think about that. I'm going to make helpers fit for him. I mean, you just have to read, like, just read the story, man. You know, like, read the story. What does it say? I'm going to make a helper suitable for him. And who is the helper suitable for him? Well, the helper suitable for him is a woman, right?
Yeah.
And so part of what's, and then, so, like, God, like, before he makes woman, like, he parades the animals in front of him. And because man is the ruler of the animals, man names all these animals, right? So man names the animals. And then it says there is no helper found for him from among the animals. So God's going to make a helper suitable for him, like a singular helper suitable for him. There's none to be found from the animals. So he puts him to sleep. He takes a rib out of him, right? He turns that into not two women to be two helpers for him, right? But one woman. So he hands this one woman to him, right? Who's going to be this helper fit for him. That's obviously the story that notice how like Adam names his wife, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you think about like the New Testament theology of marriage and everything else, that they're picking up on all these details that are in the text right there, assuming that we should be doing so too. Like that it was just obvious from the beginning, right? So Adam is Adam is the head of the wife because he was created first. And she was made for him, right? So man was not made for woman. Woman was made for man. So you get this theology of who men and women are based on these small little details within the text, like meaning like she was made for him. That means she needs to be submissive to him. And he names her, right? Like, and so he's the head of her, just as he named the animals, he names her, right? So mm-hmm. the New Testament authors are picking up on all these details that, like, some person who demands a certain kind of specificity would ignore. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So you have like a person who, like, so like the idea of like what the expectation of people advocating for polygamy is that you're going to have like a very specific kind of condemnations in order for you to draw certain principles. But then all I'm trying to say is, like, look at the way the New Testament writers interpret the Old, and at every single point, they're picking up on all these details within the text that are right there that you should pick up on in order to draw certain conclusions that were not even spelled out at the beginning. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So, I mean, you, like, a lot of the conclusions that are drawn, like a wife submit to husband because, like, he is the head of the wife and she is, she's a helper fit for him because she was made for him. He wasn't made for her. A lot of that wasn't even intentionally spelled out, you know, for the entirety of the Old Testament age, but it was there. And when Jesus comes along, he explains a lot of these things in Paul and everything else. And so, like, all right. So you think about, like, what's happening there. That's the foundation for what marriage is. God creating a woman as a helper to man, you know, man being naming her and everything else. So she, like, he's going to make this helper suitable for him. He creates a helper suitable for him. That's what he's designed the world to do. Then he says, be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth and subdue it. That's the story, right? So then they fall under sin. And I mean, you really don't have to, I mean, these are some things that you can, as you're reading through the narrative, it's really interesting because, so you read through these genealogies and, like, there's a lot of things in the genealogies that people are generally tempted to miss, basically. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you think about Genesis 5:1, this is the book of the generations of Adam. When God created man, he made him in his likeness, male and female, he created them and he blessed them and he named them man when they were created. So when Adam lived 130 years, he fathered a son in his own likeness after his image and he named him Seth, right? So the days that Adam fathered Seth were 800 years and he had other sons and daughters. So like you have like these genealogies essentially. So, and then they get down to, you know, verse 22, Enoch walked with God. Enoch lived 65 years. He fathered Methuselah. Enoch walked with God after he fathered Methuselah 300 years. You see within like Adam's genealogy that, you know, at a certain point, people began to call upon the name of the Lord. And then when you read through the other, you know, the genealogy of Cain, what you're going to find is like, this is the seed of the serpent, right? So the seed of the woman, this is one genealogy that's going to be born out throughout the whole chapter of Genesis. On the other hand, like with Seth's genealogy, you see the first instance of polygamy is going to be with Lamech, right? So, mm-hmm. like the idea is like when Lamech, like the idea is what's it called? Lamech's the first one who has polygamy. Like, so this is coming from Cain's line. So he has two wives, Adah and Zillah, and so like that's the first mention of polygamy. When you go through the narrative, what you're going to find at every single point is that it goes bad. So you think about the story of Abraham with Sarah and Hagar. God gives certain promises to Abraham that he's going to have a son, right? He's going to have an heir through him. And they take matters into their own hands, essentially. And, you know, Sarah gives, follows Eve's example of, you know, giving him like the short, you know, the quick answer to this problem and all that. So she gives her maid to Abraham. And immediately what happens is now you have conflict that's introduced within the home, right? So you think about that story, all of a sudden Hagar looks upon Sarah with contempt because she was able to give Abraham an offspring, give him a child, and she wasn't. And Sarah looks at that and says, yeah, may my wrong be upon you because I gave my maid into your embrace. So you have, you know, you basically have a story of Abraham, like, listening to the voice of his wife, just as Eve did, taking on a second wife, and instead of just letting God fulfill his promises as he said he was going to do, right? They took matters into their own hands. That brought conflict within their home. And we're still dealing with that conflict today. Like, I mean, the reason why Hamas exists today is because of this dumb decision that was made, you know, at the beginning of history. But I mean, you know, the same thing happens throughout, you know, so you have like Jacob and Esau. Esau's multiple wives make lives miserable for Isaac and Rebekah. Jacob comes along. I mean, you think about like Jacob gets tricked into marrying Leah, and then he doesn't love Leah, and he loves Rachel, and then they engage in this breeding competition between the two of them to see who can get the most offspring. And then at some point, Leah has to pay Rachel in order to have a night of intimacy with her husband. It's like, this is just a nightmare. This is a disaster at every point. You know, as you read through, you know, Solomon with all of his wives, like the law says that kings should not multiply wives. He did. Hit the foreign women, you know, the sad word is the foreign women drove his heart away from the Lord. I mean, every single time this comes out, I mean, it's just bad news every single time. So, I mean, it's just, that's what you're supposed to do when you read these narratives, is you're supposed to look at the foundational principles you see in Genesis 2:24. And then what you see when they vary from those foundational principles, the damage that happens from it, right? So this practice came from the ungodly line and then became normalized. And every time the patriarchs are doing this, it's just train wreck, right? So train wreck from start to finish. It brought conflict within, you know, David's home with his multiple wives. It just, this isn't the way to do it. I mean, and you can just, you know that this is true because, I mean, you think about the nature of the way that God has made the world. I mean, in some sense, you don't even need the Bible to tell you this. And I know that sounds blasphemous, but I'm just saying, like, just think about the way the world works. Knowing what you know about what God commanded in the beginning, like be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth and to do it. That's God's design for mankind. I mean, your nature is screaming this design. I mean, there's a reason why the human population is roughly divided between male and female, even today, right? Mm-hmm. So you think about that, like the population today is roughly divided between male and female. Like, in knowing that, like, I mean, it's like 51, it's like, you know, maybe 51% men, 49% women. I mean, this, like, these ratios are baked into the fabric of nature, right?
Yeah.
So you think about that, and then you think about the idea of like a man taking multiple women. If there's already slightly more men than women, like to budget for, you know, male stupidity, getting themselves killed. Like, you think about that. Like every time a man marries two women, he's preventing another man from being fruitful, multiply, filling the earth and subdue it. You see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Like that's just the nature of the world that God made. So, you know, anyways, but yeah, it goes bad every time. I mean, that's the narratives in painstaking detail show you this is like not, this is not Genesis 2:24. This is not Adam and Eve in the garden. This is something else, right?
Yeah. Okay. Well, I think that's a good place for us to wrap up the episode on, and we can continue talking about this same topic and a part two episode, if that's all right. So we appreciate all you guys for supporting us week in and week out. We appreciate the interaction that we get with you guys on social media, especially whether it's on the polls, you know, answering the various questions that we're asking that we might potentially turn into an episode. We thank all the people who are liking and subscribing to the YouTube channel, to the podcast, leaving 5-star reviews. Those are really great ways that you can help support us that are completely free to you and only take a few seconds, but then they are incredibly beneficial for us. So please continue to do that. And if you'd like to support us financially, you can do that through Patreon. There'll be a link down in the description, as well as links to the rest of our social media pages. So again, we thank you for all the support, and we'll see you on the next one.
This has been another episode of Bible Bashed. We hope you have been encouraged and blessed through our discussion. We thank you for all your support and ask you to continue to like and subscribe to Bible Bashed and share our podcast with your friends and on social media. Please reach out to us with your questions, pushback, and potential topics for us to discuss in future episodes at BibleBashedPodcast@gmail.com and consider supporting us through Patreon. Now, go boldly and obey the truth in the midst of a biblically illiterate world who will be perpetually offended by your every move.